My name is Tom Witt, and this is a session, I forgot the title of the session again, why I don't pay all my income debt. It's, the session really is a session on war tax resistance and war tax refusal. So if you came for the purpose of finding out how you could get out of paying your income tax for other reasons, maybe it's not quite the session you want to be at. Maybe I should first ask whether there are any IRS agents here or anybody works. I know there's a CIA agent. I want to start by saying that there really are many types of tax resistance and tax avoidance. And this is a session specifically on war tax resistance because of some people's firm belief in the immorality of modern warfare and the idolatry of militarism. And the immorality of the taxes levied to support that kind of warfare. I was thinking today that it was just about 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago, that I became a war tax resister here at Holden. So it seems strange that 10 years later now I'm still doing sessions and talking about war tax resistance. There are also very many reasons to resist paying war taxes, and that ought to be clarified. There are some people who believe that it's a very rational stance to take. Many are simply humanists who believe that it's inhumane to pay for something that kills, and that war will cease when we cease paying for it. So there are those kinds of people that simply take the rational approach. There are also people who are, would call themselves pacifists or nuclear pacifists, those who might not be necessarily opposed to all warfare, at least not until the advent of nuclear weapons or modern technology, but now believe that any kind of war is immoral because of nuclear armaments and other kinds of modern warfare, including low-intensity conflict. And there can never be another so-called justifiable war under our church's criteria, or they just simply believe that war can never be justified again and believe that they need to begin withholding their taxes. There are also anarchists who are war tax resistors who believe that we should try to avoid paying taxes at all costs because the government is obviously unable to manage things so that we ought not to give them any money. Nor support in any way. Some believe tax resistance is a very un-American thing to do, and there are others who think that tax resistance gets at the very roots of patriotism. So there are people on both sides of that issue. And it's also a stance that more and more Christians are taking, precisely because they believe payment of taxes to be a faith issue. And that's sort of the tack that I'm going to take, because it was 10 years ago when I started thinking about war tax resistance that it was really in response to biblical study that I began thinking about this. We were studying that winter, Dan remembers, The Politics of Jesus, and by John Howard Yoder. And then I was just past draft age at that time, and part of me was thinking, boy, I don't have to go through that, I'm pretty lucky. And then another part of me, after reading some articles, realized that, hey, there are some other ways in which I'm connected to militarism, and I better pay attention to that. So after some reading, I decided that that's something I needed to do. Anyway, as an introduction, I want to say there's many ways to approach this subject, and I hope that you don't mind us ending on a semicolon tonight, because we're not going to get to all of it, but just simply to some of it, and I'll give you an introduction to some of the reasons behind why people are undertaking such action. I also want it to be clear that I'm starting with an assumption tonight that maybe all of you don't agree with, or maybe you do, but I need to lay it out there. And again, this comes from my own biblical study here at Holden and other places, that I'm starting with the assumption that the Bible has lots to say about opposition to violence, to militarism, and it advocates other ways of dealing with our enemies, both on a personal level and a corporate level. And has lots to say about other ways of working for justice. So I'm making this assumption clear from the beginning that as Christians, we need to be saying no to the arms race in some way. And I'm saying that not because maybe we're all agreed upon that, but that's where I want to start tonight. And maybe we could have another time, another session sometime in the next couple of days if we want to talk about whether or not Christians should be opposed to the arms race. Because I think that would be an important discussion to have, because there might be some diversity here in that. But I want to start with that assumption that we need to be opposing the arms race in some way, if not out of a New Testament love for our enemies, at least for the sake of our own children. I also want to take a brief look at what the Bible has to say about taxes. We'll do that briefly because of time. But I think it's important first to start by looking at taxes in this country. There may be some assumptions about taxes or some understandings that we all should have. War tax resistance, by the way, has very deep roots in this country. War tax resistance predates the Constitution. The revolution in this country really started with war tax resistance in the Boston Harbor. But until recently, this kind of resistance to war has been common only among primarily members of the historic peace churches, the Quakers, the Mennonites, the Church of the Brethren. And some of those folks anyway, were tax resistors during the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, but never really in larger numbers until after the Vietnam War, when lots of folks, including some mainline denominational people and non-religious people, became tax resistors. This was partly because income tax in this country was such a minor part of the federal budget. It was early on, I think, in World War II, it was only about 3% of the population that was paying income tax when it was started, or in the 1940s. And then it shot way up because of World War II. But it's really important, I think, from the beginning to note that federal income tax was first imposed in this country as a direct result of war. It was started in 1862, after the Civil War, and then really was expanded so that more people paid it later on, and it was revoked a number of times during the late 1800s and early 1900s. But income tax has been the main source, financial source, for war and war preparation ever since. So there's a very important connection between the taxes that we pay and the wars that we're involved in. If you look at a graph sometime at our tax levels and the wars we've been in, it's a very interesting graph, because tax levels climb during wartime and then they drop off after war, but they never drop back down to where they were before the war, because we're always still paying for it. That could be a whole session sometime. We won't talk about that now. But tax figures today continue to change with every new approved budget. And what I have, I'll give you the latest figures that I have. Well, actually, there's later figures than these, but these are the figures that one would have used in figuring out one's tax in April of this year for paying for 1989. But this is fiscal year 1989, federal budget. And I don't know if you can see the statistics here, but current military spending now is 34.7% of our income tax dollar. Past military spending is 19.2%. That would include in it veterans benefits, as well as interest on the national debt that's attributed to military spending, or attributed to past wars. Total military-related costs is 53.9%. One thing that I think it's important to point out about this budget pie is that you may have seen at some point tax figures that were around 24 or 25% of our federal income tax dollar. And if you have, I need to explain that, because oftentimes you see this budget pie in a little different form, and it's a really interesting development. But the federal government gets money, obviously, to run non-military programs from a variety of sources. Some money they get specifically for non-military related programs comes through trust funds, the largest of which is Social Security. There's also an airport trust fund that you pay when you fly. There's a gasoline, a highway trust fund. There's some others. But when the government prints the budget, what they do is they combine trust fund money and income tax money together in what is now called a unified budget. And this was not always the case. Before about 1963, there were two separate budgets. There was one for federal funds, and then there was one for trust funds. Now, trust funds are allegedly raised for a specific purpose and only used for that purpose. They cannot be used for military programs. So what this was a device during the Johnson, a convenient device during the Johnson administration to really downplay the amount of money that was being spent on the military during the Vietnam War by combining trust funds and federal funds into a unified budget. And what I have up here is the federal funds, which does not include trust funds. It's a more accurate portrayal of what we really pay with our tax dollar and not with Social Security. It's really interesting how this has been used. I'll read it, just a paragraph from an article that was in the Lutheran magazine, for those of you who are Lutheran, that was written a number of years ago by a Lutheran, Edwin Meese III. And he was writing about, called A Strong Strategy for Peace. And he was talking about how the United States during the 80s, 70s and 80s has decreased its real military spending, according to Ed Meese. And as a result, now there's a danger that the military balance had shifted against the United States. He said, in the early 1960s, 46 to 48% of the national budget was devoted to defense or national security purposes, and 26% devoted to social purposes. Today, that's just reversed. Some 48% is devoted to social needs, with 26 or 27% devoted to national defense. But while the United States was changing its pattern, the Soviet Union response was to increase its military spending. What Mies doesn't say in here is that in between them, they started figuring out things differently. They created a unified budget so that it was a deceptive use of statistics, that the accounting and the rhetoric has changed, but not the reality. You just juggle the figures so that they look a little bit different. So we need to realize that it's a large part of our tax dollar that's being spent. And budget pies, you can't tell everything from budget pies, but I think from budgets they reflect priorities, and priorities reflect values. And if you were to look at this budget pie, you would think that the main value here in the United States is militarism. I just have one more graph to show you that may be helpful. This again I think this is actually fiscal year 1988. The federal budget, where it shows some comparisons of what we spend in this country on low-income housing, $7 billion, natural resources and environment, $14 billion, food is $19 billion, education, $29 billion, health is $41 billion, and to be accurate about what we spend on military spending, you really have to pull this out here.
Oh, good dreams on Christmas.
$312 billion in 1988. Now, I just asked Dick, and this year, Bush's proposal is about $303 billion. So you've cut out about this much. And with a democratically controlled Congress, you could probably cut out some more here, because he won't get quite as much as he asked for. So it'll probably still hover somewhere around $300 billion. Maybe just under if we're lucky. But that's where we're at. I think there's a lot of different points you can make about this. One is that we as church people probably pay 3 to 4 to 5 times as much to the military as we do to our churches and for lots of other things. It also points out the drastic change in the nature of warfare during the last century, because as long as huge armies were necessary to wage wars, then if you didn't believe in killing, if you thought that was immoral, then an appropriate response or appropriate witness might be conscience objection. In other words, you object to the government using your personal services to kill. But now when it becomes possible through automated warfare to destroy with unmanned aircraft, with ICBM Tridents, with minimal personnel, then the witness of withholding one's economic support becomes of even greater importance, because, and this is especially true for Those of us who are beyond draft age, it's true for women, it's true for older people, for younger people, for everybody. We all have a connection to warfare through our pocketbook. Conscience objection goes beyond just those who are of draft age and can be out there in the battlefield. So the point here is if we're troubled about war, we should be troubled about taxes, because warfare demands less of one's person today than it does of our pocketbook. And that's precisely the aim of new forms of militarism like low-intensity conflict, where we are purposely kept sort of oblivious to what's going on and other people fight our wars, like the Contras, which we pay for through our tax dollars, but we don't have the American people coming back in body bags, so we don't feel that war, but we're paying with it through our tax dollars. Let me look a little bit, or let us look a little bit at the Bible, and I'm going to have you read a portion of scripture in a second, but I want to just introduce this by saying that when you look at the Bible and taxes, it's probably best to avoid two extremes. One extreme would be to say that the Bible commands us to pay all of our taxes all the time. I don't think that we can find that in the Bible. And that's a big hurdle for us to overcome. Donald Kaufman, who's a biblical scholar, says that it's just a tremendous struggle for people to that universal assumption that the Bible speaks very clearly with one voice regarding the necessity of tax payment by to government by its citizens. There isn't that kind of absolutist position in the Bible. It doesn't command us to pay all of our taxes all the time. But I think we need to avoid the other extreme as well, the non-payment of taxes. It's difficult to find biblical support for the anarchist position that we should avoid paying taxes whenever possible, because there's too many biblical guidelines that point to God's creation of the powers and the need for Christians and people of faith to be subjects for the common good. So I think there is biblical support for the payment of taxes. The question is war taxes. And I think it's important to keep that context in reference to the biblical message when we hear it. I'm going to read another, just a paragraph from Dale Brown, who wrote an article a while back on the Bible and tax resistance, and this just sort of sets the scene for the passage we're going to hear. And some of you heard Dan Erlander talk about this earlier week in his Bible study about taxes. Under Herod the Great, 37 to 4 BC, the tax burden had become unbearable. Though first approving the rebuilding of the temple, the Jewish people reached the point of resistance to a luxurious court and a building program out of proportion to the national wealth. There was a land tax, a poll tax, personal property taxes, export and import customs on salt, and numerous items. The burden was intensified by the fact that there were two complete systems of taxation. In addition to the tribute due foreign rulers, there was an annual half-shekel tax to the temple. It's estimated that the total taxation at the time of Jesus, both civil and religious, totaled from 30 to 40% of the total income. It's not surprising then that the scribes and Pharisees spoke of tax collectors and sinners in the same breath. The Jews of Palestine felt free from obligations to pay the tribute. Payment was often regarded as an acknowledgement of Caesar as Lord. How did the gospel writers place Jesus then in this context? In answer to the query about his eating and drinking with tax collectors, Jesus neither approved what they were doing nor rejected them as persons. Instead, he affirmed that he had come to call sinners to repentance. Since some biblical scholars find evidence that as many as half of the disciples chosen by Jesus were from the extremist or the zealot party, it's maintained that Jesus identified with many of their sentiments concerning the righteousness and justice of the coming kingdom. At the same time, he could not identify with their deep hatred and violent plans. So we do not possess certain evidence that Jesus was or was not an active teacher of tax resistance. If he was, it is fairly certain that he was a different kind of tax resister than his zealot associates. This broader context should be kept in mind as we examine the the specific passages which are appropriated as proof texts for this issue. And there are a number of them that are really proof texts used by people who maintain that we should pay our taxes at all times. And I've chosen one of those. If you could just read that, it's from Matthew 22. I'm sure you'll recognize it.
Then the Pharisees went and took counsel how to entangle him in his talk. And they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully and care for no man, for you do not regard the position of men. Tell us, then, what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the money for the tax." And they brought him a coin. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" They said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Render, therefore, to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." When they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away.
This story is interesting because there's two normally antagonistic parties, the Pharisees and the Herodians, joining forces. They were usually at odds with each other, but they come together to try to trap Jesus, to get him to commit himself one way or another. Obviously, if Jesus says, yes, pay the tax, then he's in trouble with the people. If he says, no, pay the tax, he's in trouble with the authorities. The fact that this issue is raised means, I think, that taxes, the payment of taxes was an issue. Tax resistance was an issue in that time. But Jesus' answer, I think, is really interesting. When he calls for the coin, you'll see in the asterisk at the bottom of that passage, the coin is what normally people would have had in their pocket would have been the Tyrian shekel. But this passage says what was pulled out was a denarius. And it wasn't the common currency in Palestine at the time, but it was a Greek coin which had an image of Caesar on one side. It was minted on the other end of the Mediterranean, and it had an inscription below Caesar's image that claimed the divinity of Caesar. Most Palestinian Jews would never have laid their hands on that kind of coin. So the fact that they had that coin in their pocket was the coin of the oppressor, was evidence already of their being implicated with or closely associated with Caesar or being of the government of Caesar. Some scholars go so far as to say that, you know, what Jesus was saying is, look, you've already aligned yourself, or you've obviously chosen who you serve, so give to your Lord and God what belongs to your Lord and God, but render to Yahweh what belongs to Yahweh. But in the end, there's really no absolute conclusion what to do. It's thrown back onto the Pharisees and Herodians as to decide what faithfulness means and what allegiance means, just as there's no clear-cut answer for us, it's thrown back onto us. What I think the story does that's very helpful for me in thinking about taxes and faith is that it puts the things that are God's and the things that are Caesar's into some sort of tension. And I think so often, especially in this country, we see that there are spiritual things that are sort of up there, God's things up there, and then there are Caesar's things down here. And Jesus' answer points us to some demands, I think, that overlap or compete or sometimes conflict. They're really in tension. And I find this in studying American civil religion in college, that it's very hard for us in America, in a so-called democracy, when Caesar isn't out there somewhere, but in a democracy, we are Caesar. So that means that we have to look for some sort of conflict within ourselves. And most often, that's uncomfortable for us, so we simply go on living as though there's no conflict between Caesar and God. That we can live in America and be Caesar and not be in conflict with God, and that those demands don't overlap somehow. And I think that this is a very helpful story in saying that, yes, there are some competing demands. The point, I think, is that at certain points, a Christian's commitment and allegiance to God may set them in opposition to the authorities. And I believe that it's valid for Christians to break laws which require them to do something diametrically opposed to the gospel, or laws that prevent them from following the gospel. And that's been true throughout our church history, that there could be situations where faithfulness might lead to conscious violations of laws that prevented people from doing God's will. It's certainly true in the early church. More recently, I think you can look at lots of different instances where that was true for Christian people. The few confessing church people in Nazi Germany broke laws to resist Hitler. We now applaud them. Or our brothers and sisters in South Africa who break laws to oppose apartheid. Or in this country, we applaud now those who disobeyed the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850. You could go on and on and on, but the question is the arms race, is militarism one of those places, one of those points where faithfulness to Christ might lead us in that direction? It's not as though, as Christians, that we're first and foremost about resisting the U.S. government or resisting paying taxes, but perhaps, at times, the only way to say yes to the gospel is to resist something evil. And that resistance is as a response to our call to be peacemakers. And that's why I think tax resistance is extremely important to think about, because more and more people are discovering that paying taxes for war is disobeying Jesus' call to love our enemies, to do good to those who hate us, to bless those who persecute us, and to do justice. So my main point is not to come across as saying, if you want to be faithful, then you have to be a tax resister. I don't think that's the point, but it's more that paying taxes should be a faith issue for us. And it's a vital question in relation to our call as peacemakers, because if we're concerned about war, and I think we have to be, then we have to be concerned about taxes. So that April 15th, I think, is a day, a faith question day for us when we fill out our taxes. And so that's more of what I'm trying to say. I'm not coming here saying you all should do tax resistance, but I'm coming to share my own experience with it and that it's become a faith issue for me. What I would like to do now for just a very brief time is outline some ways in which people today are doing tax resistance, and then what I want to do is say what I think tax resistance is not as a symbol or a witness, and what it is or what it can be, and then open it up for some questions and comments. There are many different ways to be a tax resister. Most of them are illegal or extra legal, whatever you want to say. But there are steps you can take that do not involve civil disobedience. Many people simply pay their taxes, but write their Congress people and write letters to the IRS as they send in their tax forms. This is perfectly legal. It doesn't involve withholding any money. Some people withhold a token dollar, which also doesn't get you into any legal trouble, but they write letters along with their tax form, and then they copy those letters to their Congress people. I know a lot of people who do that and feel like that's where they are and that's what they need to do. There are people who choose to live under taxable income, which I did for a while. It's very easy to do when you're employed by Holden Village, which I was for 2.5 years, to stay under taxable income. Other people find it more difficult. I don't know what it is right now. Does anyone know? I think it's $4,200.
$5,100
for a single person? Okay, $5,100. And that's going to go up, I think, even next year. Was this the last year that it rose a little bit? Because it used to be down at like $3,200. And I consider that a form of tax resistance, simplifying your life enough so that you're not as dependent upon, that you don't have to contribute in that way. The other thing to mention would be that there's a bill in Congress right now called the U.S. Peace Tax Fund Bill that is an effort to make war tax resistance a legal option in this country. I have one brochure here. Tremendous people, I don't know if you know them, Dick, at U.S. Peace Tax Fund on Decatur Avenue Northwest, but some Quakers and others, mainly church people, are really lobbying pretty hard for this bill that would amend the IRS code so that you wouldn't pay any less taxes, but your money would sort of do alternative service in the way that soldiers or young men do alternative service. So that if you were approved, you'd send in forms and become a conscientious objector to taxes, and your money then would be put into a special fund that would only be used for peaceful purposes. One of the first purposes would be one of the highest priorities, if this were passed, would be retraining of defense workers, economic conversion, those kinds of things, so that there would be a special fund created. You would still pay your taxes, but you could be assured that it was going this way. I think this bill needs to be supported. There's 2 Senate co-sponsors and about 50 House co-sponsors, and I will leave this brochure, and the bill number is Senate 784 and H.R. 1994. Senate 784 and H.R. 1994. If you live in Washington State, the only co-sponsor is in the House, Jolene Unsold. Is that right?
Yeah.
Third district? Okay. The illegal methods, the methods that are civilly disobedient, the first one, now I shouldn't rank these in any way, but one way is to withhold your telephone tax. Many people don't realize that some of these excise taxes are war taxes, and particularly the telephone tax was originally levied as a war tax for some people because that's all it was. It was a war tax. It was after World War II, and then particularly during the Vietnam War, it shot up to about 10%. And then it was reduced every year down to 3%. And then when I was up at Holden in 1980, I think it was due to be completely taken off of our phone bill, where I think it was down to 1%. And then it went back up to 3%, and that's where it's been, I think. I don't know if it's any more than 3% right now. But that tax is quite easy to resist. One simply subtracts it from your phone bill each month, and it's helpful if you write a little note to the phone company saying, I'm not withholding my phone bill, but the taxes on your service. And most long-distance phone companies, there's enough people doing that they're aware of this, and if you send in a note each month, they will subtract it from your bill. I once had the phone company call me up and say, you forgot to put a note in this month. You still want to resist your tax, and yeah, they're very aware, and it will build up for a while as amount owed, and then they'll take it all off. Not all long distance phone companies do that, but most of them will cooperate because all they're obligated to do is simply report to the IRS that you're not paying your tax. They won't cut your service off.
Is it just the long distance taxes?
Well, it's a federal tax. No, you have federal tax on your local phone bill too, but it's the federal tax, not the state tax, right? So now that AT&T is split up, you probably get 2 phone bills like I do. Another would be to withhold all or percentage of your federal income tax and somehow rechannel that money you withhold. People choose different amounts, and I don't think there's any sort of rule of thumb about this. There are some people who simply do not file because they can't cooperate even at that level. There are other people who file but withhold all of their income tax owed. There are other people that withhold 54 whatever percent or 34.7% or a token 10%. I mean, it's all token in a sense. So people just choose what they feel their conscience is leading them to, and they don't pay that amount every year. And there are obviously different forms of different consequences for different sorts of actions. If you don't file, obviously there's some harsher penalties. I'm not going to go into right now the specifics of what all the consequences are and specifically how you do that, because I think that that's one of the last things that people need to know. I really think that the most important thing is to talk about the whys, and then I think if you're interested enough, you'll do more research, and there are some good resources out here. But I'm willing to answer those questions after I finish in a few moments here if people have questions about how and what happens and that kind of thing. But let me just finish by saying what I think tax resistance is and what it's not. And I'll start with what it's not. It's not unambiguous, or I guess I could say it is ambiguous. One of the disadvantages of vortex resistance, and I feel this a lot, is that the protest is confusing because the taxes that you're withholding are not only war taxes. Our money that we pay in is split between military and non-military purposes, and right now the taxpayer is in a bind because we have no way of resisting one or the other. And that means that if you decide to withhold all of your taxes, then you're not paying for the good things that taxes go for, and that is, you know, health, food, education, all of that stuff up there. But if you decide to withhold only a portion of your tax, then the portion you do pay still gets put into the general fund, much of which goes to the military. So it's very difficult to act with any consistency because one still ends up paying for the military unless you withdraw your entire support. So I think that that's problematic about it. Another related clarification, I don't think that tax resistance can be a stand of moral purity as though somehow it's an effort to wash your hands of the arms race or militarism. As if now that you've stopped paying taxes that you're no longer connected to military buildup. I think we're all connected to military buildup. We can't escape that. If you got a credit card or if you're at a bank that makes investments in defense industries, I mean, I think we can reduce the amount of complicity, but I don't think that we can try to wash it away completely so that it's not an effort to be morally pure. Another consideration is that it may or may not seem to be an effective protest. And this sort of depends on your definition of what effective means, but it's true that in many cases, not all, that the government can get the money back anyway, with interest, with penalties. And many times, there's not even a confrontation directly with IRS. You don't even get that sort of personal interaction. IRS cannot certainly keep up with the increasing numbers of war tax resistors, but sometimes it's ironic that tax resistors actually end up paying more money than others, more if you had not resisted paying taxes. And certainly at this point, tax resistance does not actually keep any money away from the Department of Defense. If you are successful in not paying your taxes, it just means that someone else pays a higher percentage. The Defense Department budget is not being reduced because of tax resistors at this point. Now that sounds pretty negative. Let me just flip now and say what I think it is, because I think it's a very clear and appropriate symbol of protest in this day and age, and I struggle to find those symbols. During the civil rights days, it was obvious to many that the sit-in at restaurant counters and other places was an appropriate symbol of civil disobedience against racially discriminating laws. Today, with the arms race, it's not clear to me what that symbol is of resistance that's powerful. I think tax resistance is one of the most powerful because it's a call for civil disobedience precisely at the point where preparation for war most directly intersects our lives, and that's on April 15th. When we pay our taxes. It's a call for civil disobedience precisely at the point where preparation for war most directly intersects my life. I can't think of a closer connection than the one between taxes and war. A.J. Mustey, a famous pacifist, said once, the only difference between going to war and paying for it is that one is more convenient. And in fact, to pay for it without being willing to do it lacks some integrity. So I think sometimes when we say, well, what can we do? I can't do anything. I think that's because we may not face up to the very direct connection that we have. I had a bishop, Lowell Erdahl, who used to say, when there's a fire and you want it to go out, stop throwing wood on it. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's a plant and you want it to stop growing, stop watering it. If the beast is at your door, stop feeding it. Well, similarly, if you don't want war, then stop paying for it. Secondly, in my mind, tax resistance is just one avenue of many different forms of protest. It's not the only way to resist the arms race. I'm not advocating that. But it's one very concrete act of personal witness that I think gives some substance and credibility to what we say we're about. And I don't think that we can have a budget exactly as we would like it as individuals. I mean, you have to compromise, I know that, but we still have an obligation to try to bring our actions in line with what we say we believe as best we can. So even if it's not a stand of moral purity, I've come to the point where it's to resist is a lesser evil, a lesser of two evils. And I really think that it's too hard for me to continue, you know, working for a peace organization, but every year throw all this money into the military. It just seems inconsistent. The third point has to do whether or not tax resistance is effective. I think it is, but more importantly, I think it's faithful stance because it's a point at which I've decided that I have to refuse to do something because my conscience will not allow me to willingly help finance modern warfare. It's something that I believe to be evil. I think the word there, willing, is really important. It's the question for me of paying voluntarily. I may not be able in the end keep the government from getting that money to use to build bombs or to invade Central America. I may not be able to do that, but at least I will remove my voluntary consent. I will at least make them come and take it from me rather than writing them a check every year voluntarily and leaving that issue uncontested. And that's sort of where I feel right now. Other people are very concerned about actually keeping that money away and putting a lot of time and energy into the government never getting the money. And where I have come down, and I think I'm different than some tax resistors, is that I need to remove my voluntary consent and I need to make them come and get it. I will not voluntarily make them a check so that they can build bombs. There are many people that think that protest goes unseen and is not worth the effort. I disagree. I think even if the IRS doesn't acknowledge your witness, your protest, it's seen by family and friends, especially if you do the letter writing that you need to do to family members, friends, bishops, newspapers, and congresspeople. I think people take you more seriously if you've taken a step like this. And this was certainly true with some of you might remember Bishop Raymond Hunthausen from the Seattle area when he publicly announced that he would withhold half of his taxes in the early 80s. People took that seriously because he was taking a risk. And I think that it causes some valuable debate within the church. It may be divisive, but I think that if it's done in love, I think that debate is healthy. And then lastly, one more way I think tax resistance is effective is through alternative funds. Most people that I know who withhold taxes do not keep that money themselves, but actively rechannel it into peace-promoting, life-preserving purposes. And there are lots of different alternative funds out there. The organization I work for, Lutheran Peace Fellowship, has a Lutheran Peace Alternative Fund. So there's Lutheran tax resistors that put their money in there, and then we make grants and loans to peace and justice projects with that money. Other people directly channel it into groups like Bread for the World, or groups, their local food bank, or their whatever it might be, neighborhood redevelopment, the things that I send my money down to the Share Foundation that's doing my work with Central America refugees because I feel like they are primarily the victims of some of our foreign policy. So that, you know, tax money in one way is being spent to do them harm, but other money is coming to help them. I feel like that's important. So money is not only being withheld from the military, but it's actively being put to good use. So let me end there and just, I know we've got about 20 minutes just for questions and comments. I'll just open it up back there.
I want to be sure I understood what I think I heard you say. If you, as you're doing, do not send it all in, I think I heard you say that, well, you kind of make them come and get it. Is that the right cycle? In other words, you pay when they force you to pay? Would you mind answering that? Or what's the time cycle of the year, the tax year, to when they with penalty.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, that really varies. And, you know, you shouldn't get the impression that they always get the money in the end, because they don't. A lot of people are tax resisters for years and years and years and never pay. And they channel that money in, and it gets used for peaceful purposes. Other people get caught, and they either choose to battle it, which usually ends up in not being successful. Yeah. If any of you have been to tax court, you know that you don't stand much of a chance. Other people spend a lot of time working for cash or not owning their own homes. There was just an article in Sojourners Magazine, if any of you get that magazine, about a family in the New England who are getting their house is now owned by IRS. Their house is owned by IRS, but the IRS has not taken it away. They're still living in it, but they don't own it anymore. It's very interesting. I'm sure the magazine is in the reading room, but they have gone to the extremes of fighting this and not having IRS get the money. It depends on for a couple of things. What kind of tax resistance you're doing, how much you're withholding, what percentage it is of the total tax that you owe, and just sort of happenstance, luck. I mean, some people get caught right away. In my situation, usually the money that I'm withholding is not enough for them to assign a person to my case, because that costs them more money than they would get. So I get maybe three or four letters with sort of, they're written by a computer with sort of increasing threats, and then it sort of gets dropped. There was one year when I made a mistake. I don't remember what happened, but I was owed money at the end of the year, and of course that's when they got it back. So you have to be careful about that. There are sometimes, you know, when simply what they will most often do, if it's a significant check of money, they will find your bank account and simply take it out of your bank account, and then you'll get a letter from your bank or somewhere and saying that this is a lien has been taken. Or they'll go to your employer and take out your salary. There was one of our former housemates, Mike Chirp, was working for Lutheran Campus Ministry, and they came to Lutheran Campus Ministry. It was a really interesting situation where Campus Ministry had to decide whether they were going to cooperate with the lien or not. Yeah. And that's an interesting situation now for employers, especially churches. American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers, the Mennonites are all struggling with this, and some of them had decided that they will not cooperate with a lien, and that they will not even withhold taxes if a person requests them not to withhold, so that the employer then becomes complicit in the action. Now, I don't think necessarily Lutheran employers are going to do that, but I think some of the peace churches are starting to. So, what the long answer is that it goes on for years and years and years, and sometimes they get it, sometimes they don't.
Do you have any feeling for what the quote significant amount is in general terms?
I can't remember. I thought somebody quoted me a percentage. If you're withholding, you know, more than 25% or something, or 15%, that sort of a red flag goes up somewhere. And that they would maybe work extra hard if you're withholding into that category. That's why a lot of people who don't want to take, who feel like they need to do something, but they're not willing to take that major risk, do, you know, 10% or $10, something that clearly is a step beyond where they were, but is not enough to get them in a lot of trouble.
I'm surprised it's under percent, though, because 25% could be $10.
Right, right. So I think it's more than just percentage. It has also to do with amount of money. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the statute of limitation?
That is a good question. I don't know that there is one. It may be 7 years, but...
I can look for it.
I'm not sure IRS has one, but I can quickly look at
that.
I think if you, I don't know about tax resistance specifically, but just an ordinary income tax, it says, you know, if you deliberately, if they can make the case, you deliberately defrauded or withheld tax dollars, that I don't think there is one. You go back as far as you want.
Okay, we have to go back.
Other, yeah.
I'd like to know if there are any support systems for people who decide to do this.
Besides...
There are, and that's a really important point. Lutheran Peace Fellowship has issued a call to tax resistance every year since 1981. In a way to, I mean, if you're Lutheran, it's a good thing to be a part of because you at least get the sense that you're not doing this alone. And you feel very alone on April 15th when you do this. But we have about 175, 180 people who do this every year in some form or another. And we send out a call, and then I send out resource mailings to let them know, you know, what the latest law is. There's also different funds. There's a fund in Manchester, Indiana, called Tax Resisters Penalty Fund, where people contribute to this fund as a way to support people, other people, tax resisters, who all of a sudden get caught by the IRS.
So you tax money to them instead of to the government.
Well, yeah, the money gets pooled, and then you can draw from it when you have a tax obligation than when they've caught up to you. So it's a sort of a cooperative way. If you're not getting caught, you might be helping someone else who is, and they'll help you when you get caught.
Is that just for Indiana, or is it?
No, it's a national fund. It's called War Tax Resisters Penalty Fund. It's not on here for some reason. I have that address somewhere. And then there are sort of local groups. There's also a National War Tax Resisters Coordinating Committee that's based in Seattle. It's a national organization based in Seattle. And there's also a newsletter that goes out called Conscience and Military Tax Campaign. That also comes out of Seattle. It's interesting that Seattle's sort of a hub for some of this activity. And also the Northeast is. This was an interesting piece. I'll just pass it around. War Resisters League put this out. It's called, it's out by the ARS, not the IRS, the Alternative Revenue Service. And it's called the Easy Peace Form for 1989. And it sort of says you figure out how much tax you owe, and then you figure out, you know, 54%, and then it asks you what you would like that money to do instead of go to the military. And you sort of fill it out. And I thought it was an interesting idea if you want to pass it around. There was one back here first, yeah.
How do you deal with folks maybe who aren't in this specific issue, but maybe an issue that we're in favor of, like education or welfare or whatever, that they don't want to support that and would withhold in terms of that?
You mean if they were consciously, I mean, the one people bring up most often is abortion. And it's interesting that abortion, anti-abortion advocates really did consider this and quickly dropped it because it's such a minute figure. It goes toward abortion compared to military spending. If they chose that as a tactic, it would just be, you know, literally pennies, and it's not a significant amount of money. I think if people decided to do that, if there was a large group of people that were significantly in conscience opposed to something, I may differ from other people. I think that that's an okay thing. If they're willing to pay the consequences, that may be a healthy thing. I mean, it would raise the issue that perhaps we are. Maybe something's wrong. I can't understand that people would, in conscience, be opposed to paying for education. And I guess I should say, I don't think you should be a war tax resister if you just disagree with a certain military policy or a certain kind of weapon system. I think that there's maybe other ways to, you know, to vote and to influence public policy, and I still do that. But when it comes to being opposed in conscience, and that your conscience will not allow you to do this, I think you have to resist. And if it's another issue, I can't think of what it would be, but you know, I think that you need to do that and then accept the consequences for it. But I think it's in a way a red herring when people throw that out, because there is no other spending item that is anywhere near this. I mean, if you look at this piece of paper, I don't think that there's any other issue that people have chosen this kind of tactic just because of the money isn't. No. Yeah.
You mentioned when you said what war tax resistance is not, that if you don't pay federal income tax, that the military budget will be the same no matter what you do. What does that mean? Is that true? So if I don't pay any of my taxes, or if I pay some of them and not all of them?
Well, yeah, I mean, they have a budget. They're still getting that money. It either means, you know, it means the percentage of mine is higher that goes in the military, or that, you know, we go... I don't know what it means. It just means that there isn't a direct... I think if tons of people did it, certainly something would have to happen. I mean, we would have to reduce our military budget. At this point,
probably just increases the deficit.
Yeah, it might increase the deficit. On the other hand, I mean, I think the other hand is that you take that money, and you, if you take that money and channel it yourself, it's probably used more effectively. I really believe that. Now, I wouldn't, I'm not advocating that everyone pay their taxes just however they want. So that's why I'd like to see this piece of tax fund bill passed, so that it would become a legal option, so that people could really be conscientious objectors in a legitimate sense.
I was just hoping it can come out of education or some of these other healthcare programs.
Well, you know, how do you know? I mean, I think there's other forces that are taking money away from education, and that has to do with, you know, the administrations, the particular administrations that are in power. But it's a difficult point to start with. You had your hand up.
When your 1099s go in and then you don't follow up, you don't pay that amount, how are they going to get you, aren't they?
What, you mean your 1040?
1099s, you
what's
know.
Estimated tax.
Oh, if you're self-employed?
No, your forms that your bank sends in and your
interest.
Oh, I see.
All that goes in. And they have a copy of all that. How can you avoid it?
Well, yeah, they know. I mean, they know when you don't pay your tax on time. I've already gotten a notice from April. I got it in May. So I got it within 30 days. So, and I think Computer Age is making their prosecution or follow-up much faster than it was 8 or 9 years ago. Yeah.
But they don't have on April 87.
Yeah. See, it's strange because, you know, and you probably, as a, you know, a couple resist more than I do, and it doesn't make much sense. Some of it may have to do with the area of the country you live in, but... Here.
I was curious if you were familiar with the method that Archbishop Hunthausen has taken in his resistance.
I'm not. He's self-employed, I would think. So he has control over his money, unlike a lot of us who get a paycheck and get our money taken out. So at the end, you don't owe anything. You get... usually don't owe anything. Is that what you're going to ask?
I was going to ask, because unless there's one form that you can fill out to not get withheld,
W-4.
But you have to lie, and I don't think that's the intent of tax resisters to
well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, it's really hard to get control of your own money. I mean, it wasn't always this way, but after World War II, they decided, maybe we could start taking it out ahead of time and have that money so that people wouldn't have to choose whether to pay for it or not. And then if we took too much, that's just interest-free money that the government has, and then they sort of give it back to, you know, if they had too much. So it always hasn't always been that way. Probably the most popular form of tax resistance is W-4 form, inflating your exemptions. And it, in a sense, is lying. In other sense, it's not. I mean, it's depends on how you interpret it. You don't have to say why you're taking exemptions on your W-4 form. You don't have to say because it's a dependent. It can be for an expected exemption or deduction later on. And, you know, a lot of people really consider that they're taking a war tax deduction. And so in their minds, they're not lying. And you don't, and those never get forward to the IRS. Those stay with your employer. So your IRS never sees those unless you take more than 14. Then they automatically go to IRS. And I just read in this book that the record for the most number of exemptions on a W-4, I think, is 3 billion. Somebody claimed every person in the world is their dependent. So that, you know, something like that would go to IRS. I think it'd be a little red flag. Is there a question over? Is there other hands up? Any other questions or comments? Let me leave these here. The best resource here, and again, I didn't get my act together, and I don't know if the bookstore has this.
It does.
Okay, good. Because this is the best book, really the only one out that's current. It's called Guide to War Tax Resistance. And I would not undertake war tax resistance without reading this book. I really wouldn't, because there's many things you need to know Particularly, there is now what is called a $500 frivolous fine, frivolous filing fine. So that if you are working on your 1040 form and you change the 1040 form in any way, like if you take a Vortex credit or if you don't fill in the right amounts, they can slap on you an automatic $500 fine that is separate and in addition to any other penalty or interest. So you need to be careful about that. What most people recommend that you do is fill out your form exactly, assuming that you owe some money at the end of the year. Fill out the form as it should be, and then don't pay the amount that's listed at the bottom of the form, and then write a letter along with that and let them know what you're doing. That way you can avoid that $500 fine. I think maybe there's one person out of all the people who've done W-4 resistance who've gotten a penalty fine for inflating their W-4 form.
Mm-hmm. No, I was just thinking, because isn't it a signature that you know, you're saying this is the truth?
Yeah,
and that's what we don't want to do, but I can see that in conscience you could say that I have another exemption.
Right, because you used to have to say what each exemption was for, and you don't have to do that anymore. And you can also you can also take a special exemption that's legal, right? You can take one and then you can take a special one. Or isn't that what it's called? Single people? Mm-hmm. Tell me now.
You can take
special withholding allowance. So a lot of people don't know you can do that. So you should at least be taking two if you're a single person. So check that, and you can change your W-4 at any point with your employer. You just ask them. The important thing is not to tell them what they're doing, not to tell them what you're doing, because then they become complicit if your employer knows. So, but anyway, Guide to War Tax Resistance, I think it costs $8 or $9, put out by the War Resisters League. And I'll leave this up here. Thank you. Let me just close by reading this little story. I think it's really appropriate. It's called The Delivery, and we'll close with this. It was not yet a godly hour. I was still groggy with sleep, not entirely sure whether I had really heard the doorbell or had merely dreamed it. But there he stood on the front porch, surrounded by his hardware, saying he had come to deliver. "But I didn't order anything," I said, bewildered. I tied the sash of my bathrobe. It was perfectly real. I wasn't asleep. "Yes, you did," he said. "I have it right here in black and white, all the paperwork. You paid for it. You get it." "Well, what is it?" I asked. I could, I thought longingly, be in my bed, nested snugly in rumpled sheets, sound asleep. He consulted his clipboard with its assorted manifests and invoices and said, "One XMI Abrams tank, one Minuteman III ICBM missile with hard silo, one spanking new Trident submarine with Trident missile, one medium tank of nerve gas." "Yep, that's all, ma'am." "I didn't order that," I said. "I don't want all that stuff." But the delivery man was stubborn. "Paperwork says you did, ma'am. You paid for it, remember? It's right here. $1.8 million for the tank, $40 million for the ICBM, $1.1 billion for the sub, and another $10.5 million for the missile. And a bargain, just $10 for the tank of nerve gas. You've been paying for it right along, 50 cents to the tax dollar. Sometimes these time payments pay off." "Well, I don't want them," I said firmly. I'm a great believer in firmness with salespeople and telephone solicitors. "Look, lady," said the delivery man, "I'm only doing my job, see? They told me to deliver this stuff. So will you just please sign here and tell me where to put it?" "Well, I'm not going to sign for something I didn't order," I said. "Well, where should I put them?" asked the delivery man. I was exasperated. I don't think clearly that early in the morning. I hadn't even had my coffee.